the book of Leviticus. The book of Leviticus is about holiness. The whole thing is about holiness. Leviticus chapter 18. The chapter is about sexual holiness, sexual purity. This is God teaching sex ed. This is God teaching sex ed. Now, years ago, teaching through this chapter would have been a daunting task for a pastor, a preacher, or a Bible teacher. But nowadays, because sex is thrown in our faces everywhere we look in our culture, and we've lost the ability to blush, I doubt that any one of us is pretty much going to be uncomfortable tonight. We're just so used to this. Our culture is just... well, everything is saturated in sex. You can't watch a commercial for dish detergent or laundry soap or clothing without getting some sort of sexual innuendo thrown in your faces. And it's a good reminder of why we so desperately need to hear this teaching. It would be good if we knew how to blush as a country. It would be good if we knew how to blush as a church. But unfortunately, that's been lost over the years. This gets us back to the purity of it all. As God intended it, he is going to teach us what is proper and what is improper concerning sexual relations. Now, I am not embarrassed to repeat myself on this. This is how dedicated and committed I am to making sure that you understand this. But all of those Old Testament laws pertaining to the topic of fornication apply to the New Testament church, and they don't just apply in some indirect way. They apply quite literally and quite directly. How do I know that? Church, could you cite the passage I'm going to take you to right now? How do I know that God's Old Testament laws on sexuality, the issue, the topic of the sin of fornication, how do I know that all of it applies to the New Testament church? Acts chapter 5. Did you say it's in there? Good enough. It's in there, folks. It's in the Bible somewhere. Acts chapter 15. Acts chapter 15, the decision of the Jerusalem Council. These are in the New Testament days, not the Old Testament days. I keep bringing this passage before you because I want you to know this. If you don't really truly understand the huge nature of what took place at that council meeting in Acts chapter 15, what you're going to do as a Christian is you're going to skim the Old Testament law of Moses. You're going to be confused about what applies to you directly and what applies to you indirectly. And you're probably going to pick and choose. That's what the majority of Christians out there do. They don't understand the logic of any of it. They don't know what applies to them directly and what doesn't from the law of Moses. So they pick and choose. I would love it if this church was absolutely solid on this point. You knew this, you understood this, and as a result, you were able to teach other Christians about this. There is a great need out there in Christian circles for this knowledge that I'm sharing with you over and over again from Acts chapter 15. Let me read it to you. Acts chapter 15, verses 5 and 6, first of all. It says, but some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed, which by the way, this is just a side point, but that is an amazing thought, isn't it? After Jesus' resurrection and ascension, there were a group of Pharisees that believed in Jesus. We know Nicodemus was one. We know Josephus was the other. Joseph of Arimathea. Josephus was an Old Testament historian. Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, but we don't get to read about the other ones. There were other ones. Other Pharisees came to faith in Jesus, but because they were Pharisees and they had that hard stance of legalism in their history and therefore in their nature, it was tough for them to see the difference of where the law of Moses stopped and the grace of Christ began. So some of the sect of the Pharisees who believed rose up, saying, "It is necessary to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses." So this group of Pharisees that were believers in Christ, genuinely saved, no doubt, they thought it would be a good idea for New Testament believers, even Gentiles, to live by all of the Old Testament law. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all of it. But the Jerusalem Council sought the Lord's heart on this. They agreed together on a decision, and they sent a letter by the hand of Paul and Barnabas to the Gentile churches. And this is what that passage says. This is Acts chapter 15, verses 24 through 29. "Since we have heard that some who went out from among us have troubled you with words, unsettling your souls, saying, 'You must be circumcised and keep the law,' to whom we gave no such commandment," verse 28, "it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay on you no greater burden than these necessary things," verse 29, "that you abstain from things offered to idols, from blood, from things strangled, and from sexual immorality," fornication. "If you keep yourselves from these, you will do well. Farewell." So I've laid this out to you multiple times. I'm going to do it again just to make sure you really, truly got it. I don't want it just to be back there rattling around in your brain, maybe capable of being recalled from time to time. I want it in the forefront of your brain. Anytime you're reading through Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Exodus even, I want you to know what directly applies to you and what you need to take and apply indirectly through a spiritual principle. So there they are. Those are the issues. When you come across those issues and those laws in the Old Testament law of Moses, you know you are to apply them directly and literally to your New Testament Christian life. This is not to be confused with the Ten Commandments. Does everyone understand that? That's an all better, all different title. That is not the law of Moses. That's the law of God, the Ten Commandments. God gave the Ten Commandments for every single person on the planet. Those are his laws for living on this planet. How do I know that? Jesus confirmed it. Jesus absolutely confirmed the Ten Commandments, usually summarizing them into two categories, loving God and loving others, right? So when it comes to the law of Moses, there's two branches of that. There's the ceremonial law and there's the civil law. As far as the ceremonial law is concerned, what? You can toss that out. We don't go by that anymore. We don't go through the sacrifices. We don't meet in the tabernacle or the temple. That system has been brought to an end. But the civil law aspect of the law of Moses, you got to be careful and make sure you are applying it in the correct way. One of the doctrinal items from that Jerusalem council was abstinence from fornication, sexual immorality. And again, this is repeat too. You should know what the word fornication means. It means sexual immorality. It means sexual sin. And I shared with you a while ago in that five-part sermon series that we did on singleness, divorce. I always do that. I put divorce in front of marriage. That's terrible. It is not a Freudian slip, okay? Singleness, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. That five-part sermon series that I did, I shared with you that that word, fornication, is the big word. It's the umbrella category where you could squeeze every sexual sin underneath it, and it's accurate. Fornication would be all of it. Heterosexual sin, marital sins, homosexual sins, bestiality, all of it. It falls under that general category, that umbrella category of fornication. So what does that mean? Why all this buildup? Why all this recap? What that does is it tells us that the New Testament Christian studies Leviticus chapter 18 and applies it how? Directly. literally. This is not to be taken in some spiritual way and applied indirectly in a way that we see fit or choose. It is to be taken literally. It is to be taken directly. When the Jerusalem Church Council decided that the New Testament definition of fornication was the same as the Old Testament definition of fornication as defined in the law of Moses, what that did was bound us to the law of Moses when it speaks on the topic of sexual sins. And that is extremely vital and crucial for you to know. Extremely important, because the world wants to define fornication in their own way. They want to pretend as if the New Testament did not ratify the Old Testament definitions. That is false, that is inaccurate, that is error. We are to take it directly, and that is what we are going to do right now. Verse 1, Leviticus chapter 1. You guys sweating for? It's not even hot in here. No, I'm kidding. It actually is hot in here. That's why I'm sweating. Verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 2, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord. Lord is in all caps. That means the original Hebrew word that that translation is connected to is the tetragrammaton, what we call the tetragrammaton, YHWH, or Yod, He, Wow, He, from which we get the name of God, Yahweh, and Yahweh means I am. I am that I am. He says basically that same thing here. I am that I am God. I am means the eternally existent one. He is completely self-sufficient. He lives outside of time and space, all of those things that wreck our brains for a while when we think about them. He never had beginning of days. He never had ending of. He will never have ending of days. As we spoke about on Sunday morning, he is the only, truly, purely eternal one, right? So the Lord, I am the Lord, Yahweh, your God. Now, just a quick note about that, get us started. Not very far into this, only verse 2, and the Lord already is establishing for us his credentials to make the laws and to set the demands that he is going to do concerning the sexuality of the child of God in this chapter. If you look at the last verse of this chapter real quick, we won't get to it tonight, but verse 30, you'll see that the Lord finishes this chapter in the same way. He begins it by saying, I am the Lord your God. Here's the laws. And then he ends it by saying, don't forget, I am the Lord your God. That's a great thought to have in mind as you approach the scriptures. That's a great thought to have in your mind as you conclude your time spent in the scriptures. When you come to study, first thought should be, he is the Lord, my God. He wrote this. He knows better than I do. I'm just a human being. I am going to receive it. And then at the conclusion of study, all right, Lord, some of that may have been tough. Some of that may have been challenging. But after all, you are the Lord, my God. Excuse me. The Lord, my God. This statement is repeated 5 times in this chapter alone and 40 times in the remainder of this book. But for now, I want you to think of it in terms of this chapter alone. In this repetition, what the Lord is doing is establishing his credentials to make this statement, to give these demands concerning the sexual life of his people. If anyone were to rise up and to claim to have a better way of approaching sexuality, if someone would rise up with a study and say, well, the studies say this ain't all that bad, maybe the Lord was wrong. Anyone that would rise up with an opposing viewpoint on the topic of sexual sins, a viewpoint that does not adhere to the scriptural viewpoints, then I think the Lord would want to say, let's see your credentials. Here's my credentials. I'm the Lord, your God. I've been around way longer than you. And in order to establish a proof that your approach to sexuality is better than mine, then your credentials need to be better than mine. And good luck on that one, because the Lord was before was. He always has been. He is. He always will be. And everyone else is just a wannabe. So what I'm telling you folks is don't be impressed by the PhDs behind the name of the people that release their studies on what's okay sexually and what's not. Don't be impressed by the earthly credentials of the people that would try to tell you that God's approach to sexuality is outdated and unneeded. Don't listen to them. Well, but Dr. Phil said, I don't care what Dr. Phil said. Dr. Phil's wrong on probably more than half of the things he says, all right? When it comes down to it, we are flawed people. We do not see as God sees. Only God sees all things, knows all things, and knows what is going to harm us in any category of life, but especially, considering our topic tonight, the issue of sexual sin. Only he knows what's going to harm you. You're not going to know until after the fact. You may be emboldened by someone that says, nah, it's okay, it's just two bodies, it's just, man, it's just fun, relax. No, you're going to find out in the end that the Lord is right. So don't mistake the certification of a nation as a green light for a safe practice in some area of sexual immorality. Listen to the Lord. Don't be persuaded by public opinion. Listen to the Lord. He has spoken authoritatively on this topic, and he is the only one uniquely qualified to do so. Remember, once again, sin is not bad for us because it is sin. Sin is sin because it is bad for us. That statement simply says God doesn't set arbitrary rules and say, follow these. I mean, they're fine for you. They wouldn't hurt you, but they're bad for you because I say they are. So don't do them. You will find this to be a truth. Anything that God calls a sin in the scriptures, he does so because he knows that it harms us in some way, mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually. There is harm in carrying through with sin, and the Lord would have us to avoid that. Doesn't matter how much you justify yourself, how thoroughly convinced you are that what you're doing isn't all that bad, even though God called it a sin. It is destructive to you. It is harming you. And you ought to listen to the Lord, your maker. Verse 3, according to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. And according to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. Verse 3, I really like that verse. The Lord says, don't do what they did where you were. And don't do what they do where you go. In other words, don't let what happened to you in your past fashion your viewpoints on sexual practices in the present. And don't let your perceived experiences of the future fashion your viewpoints on sexuality. Let those beliefs and those practices come from the Lord himself through Holy Writ. God was calling the nation of Israel to be sexually holy in the midst of a sexually unholy world. And the situation is no different for us. The Lord calls us to this same sexual purity, even though we are living in the midst of a sexually impure world. It meant that Israel was going to be markedly different than the cultures around them. And Christian, it means you are going to be markedly different than the culture around you. You are going to stick out like a sore thumb. And just your beliefs, your practices sexually, that is going to drive some people crazy. They're not going to be able to stand your stance on sexual purity. You know why? It offends them because it convicts them. It convicts them deep down. They know that their sexual practices are impure. They are convicted by your position. They are convicted by your life practices. And so there is probably going to be some form of persecution there, even if it is just in the form of losing Facebook friends and getting censored online by the people around you. Verse 4, you shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them. I am the Lord your God. There it is again already. Verse 5, you shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. I am the Lord. Uphold God's standards for sexuality and you will live. That's what the scriptures say. That means if you abide by God's laws for sex, you are going to live life to the fullest, to the extent that God desired for you to live it. And the opposite is true. To the extent that you transgress God's laws on sexuality, to the same extent, you will find harm, problem, discontentment, dissatisfaction, unhappiness, psychosis. Look, it is a fact. One of the greatest causes of all the psychosis in the world that we are living in right now is over this one issue of sexual immorality. I'm not out on a limb here. I'm not barking up my own tree. What I am telling you comes directly from the scriptures. Immoral sexual activity does not just give you a broken heart for a little while. It damages your psyche. Psyche is another word for soul. Solomon taught us this. King Solomon, again, if anyone should know, it would be King Solomon. And he taught us that sexual immorality destroys the soul. The more you do it, affair after affair, fling after fling, encounter after encounter with someone other than your spouse, the more you do it, the more you chip away at your very soul, your very psyche. And yet, with all of this sexual immorality in the world that we live in, we're scratching our heads and saying, why is there so much mental disorder? Why is there so much psychosis in the world? Why are people suffering from all of this depression and all of these problems? There's a really good chance it all comes back to this issue of sexual impurity, sexual sin, fornication. I know this as many of you do from experience. Unfortunately, I wish I could report to you that my history was that of absolute sexual purity and sexual faithfulness. Unfortunately, that would be a lie. That is not the case. So I have learned this just as Solomon did, the hard way, through life experience. And I can tell you this, I did learn from my experience. I did learn the hard way. I found out that what I thought wasn't so harmful really truly was harmful to me. And I found out that the Lord was right on this topic. I just thank God for his mercy and grace that forgave me of those things and allowed me to come into a place where I could love as fully as I could and enjoy as much happiness in life as possible for me. I'm thankful for those things. But I'm telling you, major warning, if you persist in these things, they will chip away, namely at those two issues right there, your ability to love in the future and your general happiness in life. Sexual sin will continue to damage that. Now, because I've learned from my past mistakes, I can go ahead and give you this guarantee. You're not going to have to worry about watching a video about your pastor one day because of some sordid sin of your pastor. That is not going to happen. My past is not perfect, but my presence is right on. My present is right on with the Lord. I see this his way. I totally get it. I totally understand, having learned from my mistakes. None of you have, I'm sure. You're looking at me like I'm completely foreign up here. You all have had a perfect track record sexually. God bless you for that. Well done. Verse 6, none of you shall approach anyone who is near. Oh, so these are the laws. Here we go. Are you ready? With that, all that to begin with. Are you ready? Here we go. The laws for sexual purity. Verse 6, None of you shall approach anyone who is near of kin to him to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord. That expression, uncovered nakedness, is a Hebrew euphemism. And what it means is to uncover nakedness for the purpose of sexual contact and sexual activity. It's not merely speaking about getting someone naked and then looking at them, which you shouldn't do that either. But what the scriptures is giving us here is a statement about having sex. Any and all of it, all included, any sexual contact, any sexual activity, all of that is considered in that phrase, uncovering the nakedness of another person. You'll notice the pronouns there are masculine, his, but it's going to flip for the rest of this passage. For the rest of this passage, the Lord is only going to be speaking to the men. And I mean, it makes sense if you get one gender doing the right thing, the other side, the other gender doesn't have to worry about it. But to be accurate, what you need to do as a female is you need to flip all of these. You need to flip the gender on them. You need to apply them to you because they do apply to you as well. By the way, he probably should have given these laws to the women. I think they probably had a better chance at upholding these more consistently than the men. But he gave them to the men. Responsibility from the Lord, number one, from the men. Be sexually pure. Now, today in most societies, at least most civilized societies, it is actually a crime. It is illegal to marry and have sexual relations with a person that is near of kin to you. It has to be a very distant family member. No jokes about West Virginia people. Come on now. No. West Virginia is a fine place, all right? It's illegal in most civilized societies, and it has to be a pretty far removed relative if you want to marry that person and have sexual relations with that person. But it does bring up the question, what about Cain and Abel? There was obviously a switch here because Cain and Abel, they had to take their wives from their own family. They had to marry their sisters, and that is true. They had to. God created Adam and Eve. Everyone else came from Adam and Eve. So Cain, Abel, they married their sisters. You'll see a lot of that throughout the Old Testament. I mean, even Abraham, the father of faith, you know, the patriarch number one, he was married to Sarah, his half-sister. And what happened? Now the Lord in Leviticus chapter 18 says, no more of that. Well, because there was a change in the atmosphere. There was a change in the general health of human DNA. We assume that in those early days, not far removed from the creation event, we assume that because the bloodline of the human being was so pure and so healthy, not degraded by time and all sorts of environmental factors, that it was an okay thing for a person. I mean, if they wanted to, I don't know why you'd want to marry a sister, but if you wanted to, it was okay to do that. It was okay to marry a family member. There would be no negative health effects to the spouses or the children that would be produced through that union. Again, sin is sin. Why? Because it's bad for us. When it wasn't bad for us, the Lord didn't have laws on it, and the people did it, and no problem. The Lord had no issues with it. When it became bad for us, unhealthy for us, through the degradation of human DNA, through the changes in the atmosphere after the flood, when it became bad for us, the Lord said, no more. The children that are born, well, I mean, you don't want a kid with two or three heads. You don't want a kid with four arms and one leg. You got to do what's healthy. This is not healthy. So no sexual relations with a person that is near of kin. Verse 7, the nakedness of your father or the nakedness of your mother you shall not uncover. She is your mother, for crying out loud. You shall not uncover her nakedness. So God says no sexual relationships with your parents. Did that really need to be said? Not for you, not for me, but yes, it did. It needed to be said because this was a practice that was taking place in Egypt, in Canaan, just about everywhere, and Israel needed to abandon that practice. Hate to tell you this, but it still happens in the world that we live in today. It still happens. How? Why? I don't know. It's absolutely detestable to me, just the thought of it. But it happens. Thus, it needed to be said by the Lord. Verse 8, the nakedness of your father's wife you shall not uncover. It is your father's nakedness, for crying out loud. I think the Lord should have put "for crying out loud" after just about every one of these statements. And I just might tonight. So, no, God is not repeating himself in verse 8. Verse 7, that speaks of your flesh and blood parents. And verse 8, that speaks of a step parent. All right, y'all see that? She may not be a blood relative to you, but she is your father's wife. Stay away from her. To do anything else would be a sin against your father. Verse 9, the nakedness of your sister, the daughter of your father, or the daughter of your mother, whether born at home or elsewhere. I like that, just so there's no excuses. Yeah, she's my sister, but she was born down the road. She wasn't born in a house. I mean, it's okay. No, the Lord says, wherever they're born, their nakedness you shall not uncover. Now, that is no sexual relations with a full-blooded sister or a half-blood sister, right? If that sister comes from one of your parents, either or both, you need to avoid sexual contact, sexual activity with that sister. Again, ladies, flip this. Same thing with a brother. Verse 10, the nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter. Do you see what this is? The nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover, for theirs is your own nakedness. So that is speaking about grandkids. Those grandkids ultimately came from your loins. What are you thinking? No sexual relationships with those grandkids. Verse 11, the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, begotten by your father, she is your sister, you shall not uncover her nakedness. Now, this is almost a repeat. This would be speaking about a half-sister. He's highlighting that point. Now, he did kill two birds with that one stone of verse 9. He talked about the full-blooded sister and the half-sister. And I guess in a measure of caution, he comes back to highlight, to pinpoint out that relationship of the half-sister. Verse 12, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is near of kin to your father. Verse 13, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is near of kin to your mother. No sexual relationships with your aunts, either from your father's side or from your mother's side. Said another way, verse 12, no sex with a paternal aunt. Verse 13, no sex with a maternal aunt. Verse 14, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother, your uncle. You shall not approach his wife. She is your aunt. And yeah, again, that is repetition, but I believe the purpose for verse 14's repetition is to highlight the fact that when you do have sexual relations with your aunt, what you're doing is you're sinning against your uncle. That's the stress of verse 14. Verse 15, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife, for crying out loud. You shall not uncover her nakedness. So no sexual relationships with daughter-in-laws. Ladies, son-in-laws. Verse 16, you shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. No sexual relationships with your sister-in-law. Now, this applies only so long as your brother is alive. Later on, the Lord is going to add to this what is called the law of levirate marriage, or we probably know it as the law of the kinsman redeemer. That law was made biblically famous by the book of Ruth. And what that law said was that if your brother had a wife and he died before he got to have children with that wife as a method of procuring his lineage, that next brother in line, supposing he was in the position to do this, and he wanted to do this, and she wanted to do this, that brother could take the widow of his former brother that had passed, and he could marry that widow, his brother's widow. And the way that that law worked was that the first child they had, that would be the namesake of his deceased brother, so that the family lineage of his brother could persist legally throughout the generations. And then from that point on, any children that that husband and wife had together, it was theirs. But that first one was dedicated to the progeny of the deceased brother. And if you want to read about that, by the way, the law of levirate marriage or the law of the kinsman redeemer, Deuteronomy chapter 25, verses 5 through 10. You can read that on your own time. Verse 17, you shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter, nor shall you take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are near of kin to her. It is wickedness. So no sexual relations with a woman and her daughter, or a woman and her granddaughter, the operative word being the word and. This needs to be an either or situation. You got to pick one. You got to pick the mom or the daughter. You can't pick both. The mom or the granddaughter. You have to make a choice, and then you have to stick with that choice. All right, what are we on? Verse 18. Nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive. So no sexual activity with your wife's sister while your wife is alive. I mean, what, you got a death wish or something? You can't do that. Again, for crying out loud. Now, if the wife died, then you could go ahead and marry that sister of your wife and have a sexual relationship with her. I would just highly recommend you make very sure she's dead. I mean, make sure. Because if she ain't, you are. She is going to kill you. All right, now we go outside the family. If God stopped at verse 18, everyone would say, okay, I get it. The Lord doesn't want me having sexual relationships with family members. No problem. Every other woman, fair game, right? Wrong. The Lord's not done speaking. He's going to leave the topic of the family. For those who would be tempted to keep it in the family, that topic was well covered exhaustively by the Lord. And now he is going to move on to sexual relationships with those who are outside of the family. Verse 19, and you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is in her customary impurity, that is her menstruation period. And we've already studied the law on this one. I did it once. You guys aren't going to make me do it again, right? You all understand what's taking place here and what's being said. We're going to move on. Verse 20. Moreover, you shall not lie carnally with your neighbor's wife to defile yourself with her. It is a sin to have sexual relations with your neighbor's wife. Guys, be careful here. Who is your neighbor? That is not merely putting just the three people that live by you off limits. This definition was given to us by Jesus himself. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 10, Jesus was talking to a lawyer. And he asked that lawyer about the law of God. And that lawyer confirmed the two great categories of law were love the Lord and then love your neighbor as yourself. And thinking himself to be cunning and seeking to justify himself, that lawyer says, yeah, but who is my neighbor, really? I mean, that's just a handful of people, right? Who really is my neighbor? And Jesus answered that question with the story. It was the story of the Good Samaritan. Y'all know that story well. The point of that story was to answer that guy and tell him that according to the law, Your neighbor is anyone that you are not related to and that you come into contact with at any point in your life. That's who your neighbor was. In other words, biblically, the word neighbor just simply means another person, a non-relative. If you know someone and they're not related to you, they're in that second category of neighbor. They're an other. I'm thinking of the show Lost now for some reason. They're an other, okay? They are other to your family. They are a neighbor. So that tells us that what this law in Leviticus 18 verse 20 is telling us is that it is a sin to lie carnally, to have sexual relations with anyone that is married to another person. Anyone. Now, at this point, I'm sure you're wondering why the Lord wouldn't just say, don't sleep with anyone you aren't married to. That would be a lot easier. Well, first of all of these practices were taking place. The Lord wanted there to be no question marks. So the Lord goes into this in great detail to remove any possibility for all of those question marks. But I want to remind you of the seventh commandment. And it is in that seventh commandment that the Lord tells us, we shall not commit adultery. Now, when the Lord gives that law, what he is telling us is that in order to have sexual relations with another person, you need to be in a legal marriage with that individual. And in that law, the Lord is telling us that any sexual relationship outside of that marriage is adultery. Adultery is the sin, the sexual sin of a married person. So as we study these laws in Leviticus chapter 18, please do understand that this isn't the Lord just saying, don't have sex with this person and don't have sex with that person and don't have sex with this person. Keep in mind that every situation the Lord is speaking about here presupposes marriage. Every one of them. So as we read these laws, we could literally read them like this. Don't marry and have sexual relationship with your parent, your sister, your uncle, your whatever. All right? That is absolutely the way that the Lord is handling these laws. It is well established already at this point in Scripture that any sex outside of a marriage union, a proper marriage union between a man and a woman, is sin. If there were any doubt about that, all you have to do is keep reading through the Bible, and all doubt about that will be removed. And by the time you get to the New Testament, that's the capstone for all of it. The Lord makes that very clear. And I just want to make sure that we understand that totally. If you haven't picked up on it by now, this chapter is speaking about way more than just sleeping with people. When the Lord says, do not lie carnally with a person, he is implying marriage. Right? We all get that. Let me think of how to word this. It's important for the Lord to do it that way. It's important for the Lord to establish these individual situations where sex is inappropriate and sinful. Because if the Lord just said, don't have sexual relationships with someone you're not married to, what are the people going to do? The people are going to marry whoever they want to have sex with, just to have sex with them, and then probably dump them when the fun is gone. So the Lord gets this. He approaches this from all different categories. He's already approached it from the marital category, and now he wants to approach it with the specifics to make sure he details out which family members are off limits. He makes sure we know that if a woman is married to an other, if a woman is married to a neighbor, if she's married, she is off limits. She is absolutely off limits to you. Well, I think this would be a good place to stop for the night, because here's why. modern culture demands that we take the last section of this chapter in a much more detailed and exhaustive approach. You know what I mean? Properly spoken, what we studied in the first 20 verses are sexual sins. Some of it I would call abomination, but what we studied in the first 20 verses to the Lord, he considers it sexual sin. Now, when we begin studying at verse 21, what the Lord is covering in verses 21 through 30 are what he refers to as abominations. So we're going to talk about that next week. Is an abomination worse than a sin? Yes. What does the word abomination mean? It means detestable. It literally means disgusting. So there's sin, and again, I would put some of the things we read already in that category of just disgusting. But when the Lord gets to verse 21, he deals with things that are disgusting, abominable, detestable, sickening to the Lord. If you're trying to figure out if you want to be here next week, let me give you the agenda. Let's set the agenda for next week. Here's the things we're going to be talking about. The only item of non-sexual nature in this chapter, which would be the topic of the offering up of children to false gods. We're gonna relate that to abortion. We're going to see the connections there and the similarities. Next, we have God's feelings on the issue of homosexuality. And then next, we have God's feelings on the topic of bestiality. That should help you decide if you want to be here next week. I expect to see a house full. I have no trouble speaking about these things. If you have no trouble hearing about these things, come on out next Wednesday. We'll talk about it in great detail. Well, maybe that sounds a little wrong. We'll talk about it sufficiently as we need to for our biblical learning. We're going to leave no doubts as of the end of next Wednesday study about where we stand as a fellowship on the topic of abortion, homosexuality, and bestiality.